Hello, it is Thursday, July 11th. I'm Lodia Vola, and I'll be reading to you today from the front pages of the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. And we'll begin, as we always do, with a description of the pictures on the headline pages of both newspapers. The New York Times, this goes with our top story. It's a photograph of Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine, who visited Capitol Hill on Wednesday. And he is standing between two congressmen and obviously having a discussion, but it looks to be pretty friendly. And then another story that we'll be having this morning is on women in Olympics. There are three black and white photographs. The first women's Olympics, there are two photographs having to do with that. The first one shows two women crossing the finish line in obviously a race. And then another photograph showing a group of women marching behind the United States flag. And this, and then a third small photograph of Alice Milliken, who organized the first Women's Olympics in 1922. And we will have that story. And then another story that we'll be doing is on Alec Baldwin. And this photograph, a colored photograph, shows him sitting at a table looking down as his wife has her hand on his cheek talking to him, bent over talking to him. That's the New York Times. And then on the cover of the Hartford Courant, we have another photograph to go with a story that we'll be doing. It shows Stefan Byrne, a young man who has Angelman syndrome, and he's sitting with his parents. They're all smiling. They're sitting in the Bushnell Theater. And then two giant photographs in the center of the page. We do not have a story to go with that, but the title of the photograph is Wind Resolution, and it says future wind power arrived by sea Wednesday in Connecticut, and it shows turbine nacelles arriving by cargo ship on Wednesday at the State Pier in New London, and it shows giant turbines being installed. And then another photograph, actually we have a story relating to this in the Times this morning, but it shows President Joe Biden standing among at least a dozen NATO leaders. And he is central, and in this photograph at least, he is speaking. And those are our photographs on the Hartford Courant. So we will now go to our top story in the New York Times. NATO is offering Ukraine a path to membership. The United States and its NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine should have an irreversible path to membership, and that irreversible is in quotes, in the alliance, enshrining the phrase in a document that was released on Wednesday during the alliance's summit in Washington. While there is no consensus yet about Ukraine joining NATO, the strengthened language shows that there is movement in that direction. The United States was once deeply skeptical about whether Ukraine was ready to become a member, and while questions remain, more and more American and European officials believe that the country will eventually be able to join. Ukraine's future is in NATO, members said in a communique, adding that, quote, we will continue to support it on its irreversible path to full Euro-Atlantic integration, including NATO membership, end quote. The document does not lay out an exact timeline for membership, which the Ukrainians have wanted, but it says the allies will continue to support Ukraine's progress on, quote, democratic and security sector reforms, end quote. U.S. and allied officials negotiated the commitments to Ukraine with new urgency, given the uncertainty over whether President Biden, a staunch opponent of Russia in its war in Ukraine, can win re-election this fall, according to officials in Washington. The officials had said it was critical that leaders of the 32 member nations who gathered in Washington this week used strong language to signal that Ukraine has a viable path to joining the alliance, even if it does not happen immediately because of the war. They also said the leaders must agree to concrete steps to ensure the alliance, rather than the United States, is the main organizer of military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Looming over the conversations is the specter of a second Donald J. Trump presidency. Mr. Trump has expressed admiration for President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, criticized Ukraine, and expressed doubts about sending any additional U.S. military aid to the nation. And in his first term, Mr. Trump talked about withdrawing the United States from NATO. Because of those concerns, officials and analysts said that Trump-proofing, and that's in quotes, the alliance and aid to Ukraine was an important element of the talks this week. Ukraine can and will stop Putin, especially with our full collective support, Mr. Biden said in a speech on Tuesday night. Beyond solidifying foundations that could endure into a Trump presidency, the leaders are also trying to head off criticism from President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who last year accused the alliance of waffling on a promise to give his country membership. Next article, Biden angling to make time his best ally. President Biden's resistance to pressure to end his reelection bid appears to be a strategy aimed at running out the clock, a play to leave his party so little time to come up with another candidate that his opponents stand down. Every day that Mr. Biden defies pressure to step aside, the prospects and logistics of replacing him become more untenable and riskier. And the potential of weeks of Democratic infighting as a united Republican Party nominates former President Donald J. Trump may start to look worse than rallying behind Mr. Biden, no matter the concerns about the 81-year-old president's health and ability to defeat Mr. Trump. It's a mess, said James Carvel, a consultant who has been among a roster of Democrats pushing for Mr. Biden to step aside and clear the way for a new nominee. Suppose he gets what he wants. Everybody gets exhausted and just says, it's too much trouble. Mr. Biden's efforts to dig in were showing signs of initial success. On Tuesday, some Democratic leaders in Congress expressed support for the president and said it was time to move on. The urgent need right now is for Democrats to stick together and focus on the danger of Trump and his extremist agenda, said Representative Diana DeGetti of Colorado. If we do that, we will win. The calendar is on Mr. Biden's side. In the coming days, attention will turn to Mr. Trump, who is expected to name a running mate before his party gathers next week in Milwaukee to nominate him for a second term. Mr. Biden will be somewhat out of the public spotlight, focusing on the behind-the-scenes campaign to keep nervous Democrats in line. There are 35 days between July 18th, when Mr. Trump is set to accept his party's nomination in Milwaukee, and August 22nd, when Mr. Biden is set to accept his party's nomination in Chicago. But the Biden campaign, working with the Democratic National Committee, appears ready to compress the calendar even further. The party is planning a virtual roll call vote weeks before the convention is gaveled to order on August 19th, a move that appears meant to leave little to no doubt about who will be on top of the Democratic ticket this November. None of this is binding. The party sets the rules, and the party can change the rules. And Mr. Biden, for all his talk this week of sticking in the race, could change his mind, particularly if another bout of discouraging polls or another performance like the one he had in his debate with Mr. Trump shakes the party's confidence and encourages more Democratic defections. Mr. Biden's show of defiance, portraying himself as standing up against elites, even as polling suggests that most voters believe he is too old to run, may be an act of self-preservation. And here's our story with the black and white photo, Olympic photos. Women in Olympics, from improper, that's in quotes, to integral. It was 1922, 2 years before the last time the Olympics were held in Paris. On a warm August day, about 20,000 people came to Pershing Stadium to watch 77 athletes in track and field, including a team from the United States. There was a parade of nations. There were world records. There were 27 journalists and news coverage around the world. And at the start, a 38-year-old woman named Alice Milliat welcomed the world to Paris. She was the founder of the International Women's Sports Federation, known in her native France as the Fédération Sportive Féminine Internationale. Every competitor that day was a woman. "I hereby declare the first female Olympic Games open," she said. Milliat was making a statement that echoes today. The male-dominated world of the mainline Olympics, busy preparing for the Paris Games of 1924, ignored the 1922 event, other than to complain about Milliat's unauthorized use of the word Olympics. They dismissed the rising idea that women should compete at all. The 1924 Paris Games had a smattering of female athletes, 135 out of 3,089 competitors, but the Olympics hardly welcomed their participation beyond just a few events, such as swimming and tennis. There were no women competitions in most sports, including track and field, soccer, rowing, cycling, and even gymnastics. Pierre de Coubertin, the founder and leader of the modern Olympics, made his attitude known repeatedly over the years. "Having women in the Olympics," he said in 1912, "is impractical, uninteresting, ungainly, and I do not hesitate to add, improper." By 1928, his thoughts had not evolved. "As to the admission of women to the Games, I remain strongly against it," he said that year. He died in 1937 and has been heralded as a visionary of sport. But in the end, well, 2024, Milliat won the fight over gender. This summer's Olympics are expected to be the first with as many female athletes as male ones. Milliat, 100 years after the last Paris Olympics, is finally getting recognition as a pioneer, Billie Jean King of sorts for her age. Biographies are being published in France. A new documentary has been shown in theaters and on television. France's National Sports Museum in Nice has a temporary exhibition highlighting Milliat. Insurers deny care and AI seeks remedy. At his rehabilitation medicine practice in Illinois, Dr. Aslan Tariq typically spent 7 hours a week fighting with insurance companies reluctant to pay for his patients' treatments. He often lost. There was the 45-year-old man who spent 5 months in a wheelchair while his insurer denied appeal after appeal for a prosthetic leg. Or the stroke survivor who was rehospitalized following a fall after his insurer determined his rehab, quote, could be done at home, end quote. Over the course of Dr. Tariq's 12-year career, these stories had become more common. The list of treatments that needed pre-approval from insurers seemed ever broadening, and the denials seemed ever rising. So in an effort to spare his patients what he deemed subpar care and himself mountains of paperwork, Dr. Tariq recently turned to an unlikely tool, generative AI. For a growing number of doctors, AI chatbots, which can draft letters to insurers in seconds, are opening up a new front in the battle to approve costly claims, accomplishing in minutes what years of advocacy and attempts at healthcare reform have not. We haven't had legislative tools or policy-making tools or anything to fight back, Dr. Tariq said. This is finally a tool I can use to fight back. Doctors are turning to the technology, even as some of the company's largest, the country's largest insurance companies face class action lawsuits alleging that they used their own technology to swiftly deny large batches of claims and cut off seriously ill patients from rehabilitation treatment. Some experts fear that the prior authorization process will soon devolve into an AI arms race, and that's in quotes, in which bots battle bots over insurance coverage. Among doctors, there are few things as universally hated. If you want to see a physician go apoplectic at a cocktail party, mention prior authorizations, said Dr. Robert Wachter, the chair of the medicine department at the University of California, San Francisco. The process was designed by insurance companies to keep healthcare costs down by reining in doctors' use of unnecessary and expensive treatments. Baldwin called reckless, and that's in quotes, on set as trial for manslaughter opens. Prosecutors painted Alec Baldwin as a headstrong actor who repeatedly shirked his duty to maintain gun safety on the set of his film, leading to the shooting death of its cinematographer. The defense argued that it was a tragic accident, that's in quotes, and that Mr. Baldwin had no reason to believe that there was live ammunition in his gun or anywhere on the set of the Western Rust. More than 2 years and 8 months after the gun he was rehearsing with fired a fatal bullet, Mr. Baldwin found himself in a New Mexico courthouse on Wednesday, standing trial on a charge of involuntary manslaughter. If convicted, he faces up to 18 months in prison. The case is being closely watched by Hollywood, and not just because of the star at the center of it, famous for many movie and TV roles, including 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live. The question of an actor's liability has weighed over the case since the beginning. SAG-AFTRA, that's all in caps, the union representing film and television workers, has argued that gun safety on sets is the responsibility of qualified professionals, not performers. Erlinda O. Johnson, one of the prosecutors, told the jury in her opening statement that Mr. Baldwin should be held criminally responsible for the death of Halina Hutchins, the Rust cinematographer, because he had failed to take part in safety checks that day to see whether his gun contained a live round, and because he used the weapon in a reckless fashion. He pointed the gun at another human being, cocked the hammer, and pulled that trigger in reckless disregard for Ms. Hutchins' safety, she said in the Santa Fe County District Courthouse. One of Mr. Baldwin's defense lawyers, Alex Spiro, argued that the actor could not be found guilty of involuntary manslaughter because it was unthinkable for live ammunition to be loaded into a gun that was being used as a prop on the set of a movie. He said Mr. Baldwin had been told that day that the gun was cold, that's in quotes, which he said communicated to the whole production that there's nothing in the gun that can hurt anybody. Cold guns can't hurt people, Mr. Spiro said. It's impossible, literally impossible. Mr. Spiro faulted the crew members who were supposed to oversee gun safety on the set, the film's armorer and its first assistant director. The armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, was convicted this year of involuntary manslaughter for loading a live round into the gun and sentenced to 18 months in prison. The first assistant director, Dave Halls, has admitted to failing to thoroughly check the revolver and agreed to a plea deal on a charge of negligent use of a deadly weapon, avoiding prison time.